This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Oh, this is nice. 99 right now. 99. Roasty toasty in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Good afternoon, the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Good to have you with us. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We're going to get to it right away with Michael Broadcorp, who's kind enough to join us. Now, if you're not following him on Twitter, he is one of the best references, sources you can find for the news about the Republican candidates and what's going on in the Republican Party. He's also got his website up and running, michaelbroadcorp.com. That's michaelbroadcorp.com. We'll make sure we link to everything there. Michael, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Matt, I appreciate the opportunity to be here so much. Thank you.
My pleasure. I actually want to start with something not really political here, but something I've seen you've been posting a lot about this. You seem to have a lot of historical love of the Watergate. This is the 50th anniversary of Watergate just happened, right?
It was, yes. I've always been a big fan of political history, campaign-related history. And it was just the recent anniversary of 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. And, there's been a number of great television series about Watergate. There was just a new streaming one, Sean Penn and Julia Roberts. They played John Mitchell and Martha Mitchell, TV series called Gaslit, which was just absolutely fantastic. If Sean Penn and Martha Mitchell don't win something, I'll be just really disappointed. Sean Penn and Julia Roberts, excuse me, don't win something, I'll be very disappointed. But Watergate is such a fascinating subject that, and we're getting, as we all with all of our history, getting farther and farther away from it. But it's just a fascinating subject to look into, and it's always held my fascination over the years. And Friday was the 50th anniversary of the break-in.
It is getting a lot of press today, even beyond the 50th anniversary, with what's going on with the January 6th hearings. I mean, was Watergate, now that we look back on it and what happened there, is Watergate more of a lesson, a political lesson that, you know, you have to be prepared to basically, you know, fall on as many swords as possible to never allow that to happen again, that you can never have another president resign in disgrace, that you have to basically do everything you can to keep them in power? Or do you think that those lessons we learned 50 years or in the years after the initial Watergate break-in, that they're still there, that eventually you get to a point where even you have to put, as Mike Pence did, put country over party, and you have to do what's best for the country. What's your thoughts on the lessons learned from Watergate?
I think one of the lessons that's very important to remember about Watergate, and I was with some friends and some neighbors, and there was a variety of discussions about Watergate over the last few weeks, but particularly in the last week. And one of the things that someone said is that the system worked during Watergate. That everything worked the way it was supposed to is that we had at that time a president who understood even the limits of what he could do, but the system worked in terms of, yes, there were a number of convictions, people charged, people lost their jobs, people went to jail. But if you look at the functions of government, the checks and balances that existed between the House of Representatives, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the spirit of that, you know, there were obviously partisanship involved in that. But if you look back at it, that was a time in which for some reason, our partisanship has become much more tribal. I mean, it's basically the Reds against the Blues, in some ways. And there's no ability to have kind of that rational kind of observation all throughout Watergate. There's partisanship that was involved, but there were a number of Republicans who came to the realization that there was just a limit as to how far they could go and what they could do. And even the president himself got to the point where he came to the realization that his position was untenable, unsurvivable. And I always wonder what would have happened if Watergate would have happened in an era of social media and mm-hmm. the kind of the cable news networks and stuff like that. Would it have ended differently? But one of the things that in the midst of all of that, all of the crimes and the intrigue and people losing their jobs, people resigning, there is also, I think, a pretty clear message that the system worked, mm-hmm. that our government worked, and the president was held accountable through the checks and balances that exist within our country. And that's, an important message from that process. And it's difficult to not watch what's going on in terms of the January 6th hearings and other things and not look back on that. Mm-hmm. Not look back on some of those hearings and some of the, there were very principled Republicans who were involved, who were concerned, along with Democrats who were concerned about what was going on. And I think we've lost a little bit of that. I don't think anyone would say that we would look back and harken back to a time of Watergate, which was a political scandal that divided the country, that was it created problems. But with the benefit of hindsight, you can look at it now and say, so many things worked right. A lot of things went wrong, but people were held accountable. And I wonder, and I think it'd be kind of an interesting observation would be, if it would have happened now, would we have had the same level of bipartisan accountability? Would there have been some of that type of discussion, and would people have held themselves, would Republicans have been as willing to hold a president accountable like was done by people in so many years ago during the midst of Watergate? It's an interesting conversation.
Let me ask you this. Is there a favorite character you have from the Watergate scandal that you love reading about?
I'm going to really nerd out here, geek out. I went to my neighbors of mine in my neighborhood had a Watergate party. And I went as G. Gordon Liddy, who I, in fact, met in 2004. And G. Gordon Liddy is a very interesting figure. Obviously, a very challenged individual historically. But he is someone who is a very kind of intriguing figure to me. From the standpoint of what he did, what he was willing to do, how far he was willing to go. Here is someone who then, after spending the amount of time he did in jail, made a career out of kind of talking about it. This is a guy whose license plate, his license plate was H2O Gate, in essence, Watergate. Here's a guy who owned it. And I've read his biography. I've read some of his stuff. He is just a larger than life kind of in the process of this Watergate. He was someone who was so incredibly loyal to the president and so willing to sacrifice himself on behalf of this passionate belief he had in Nixon and what he was doing. Obviously this guy was chasing demons. He had problems. His view of life and what he was willing to do was just unbelievable. There's obviously one of the architects of the break-in and had all of these crazy plans about what he was willing to do. Now, this is someone who once went to a party and stuck his hand over a candle to burn his hand to show how much he could tolerate the pain. This is just a bizarre individual, but this is what happened. And I think it's the people like Liddy, it's the people like Ehrlichman and Haldeman. It's the people like Colson, the type of people that existed at that time. Some of their legal antics, some of the crimes that they committed, some of the things that they did, I wonder how they would be looked on today. I wonder if they would have somewhat of cult-like following and stuff like that. I don't look at G. Gordon Liddy in any way, shape, or form as someone who I'd ever want to emulate in life, someone who I'd ever want to be like. But he is such a unique character in this story because of the extremism and how far he was willing to go. It's just a remarkable time period in American political history, and there's still some lessons to be learned from it, I think.
Yeah, definitively a bunch of guys who realized how far they could take it and didn't realize they could be stopped when they got caught at Watergate. But, yeah, that's you're right. They'd all have shows on Fox News now. I have no doubt about that.
Yes.
Let's turn back to Minnesota politics, if we can. You have been making the point that, okay, this is – for the Republicans, it's a fairly easy game plan this election cycle. Attack the Democrats on gas prices. Attack the Democrats on you know, just the economy going downhill. These are relatively easy political layups as far as attacks go. And you have noticed that, you know, Jensen himself doesn't seem to understand – yeah, there's. It seems to be twofold with him. On one side of it, he doesn't seem to be looking for the low-hanging fruit to go after walls with. But on the other side, he's trying to separate himself from his primary self and kind of create this, oh, I'm not this anti-vaxxer guy. Then he turns around and says, oh, I'm going to go after the medical practice board and get revenge for them trying to hold me accountable. And I'm like, okay, you can't have it both ways. You know, are you holding a grudge still, or are you trying to move past it? Because, you know, and he definitely doesn't seem to be ready for the statewide campaign as of right now.
Well, no. And something that was very Nixonian was his desire to go after his enemies.
Yeah.
To go after the medical board like that. Very Nixonian. Here's the problem with Jensen is fundamentally is he's a Jekyll and Hyde type candidate. And people can, you know, kind of that he's bold candidates. I fundamentally think this is what makes him a flawed candidate. He's not a disciplined candidate. You know, he is not used to, the rigors of a campaign and being held accountable for what comes out of his mouth. This is the NFL. This is the major league. This is the big league. This is the race. He has nominal primary opposition. There's always a legal primary. So Walz, I mean, he is going to be the Republican candidate against Tim Walz. And so you would think with gas prices being as high as they are, with crime and public safety being such an issue, that he would have an ability to speak in much more defined or much more disciplined manner about the race. And he's been unable to do that. I mean, you had the lieutenant governor candidate, his lieutenant governor candidate, Matt Burke, go out there and just make up without any evidence whatsoever. It appears make up the fact that Walz had purchased a property of some sort in or around the Minnesota border between Minnesota and South Dakota. I mean, let's be clear for your listeners. There's nothing illegal about the governor having an out-of-state property. But what's interesting about this kind of hit by Matt Burke is he didn't back it up with anything. He didn't have any evidence. He didn't have anything to make this claim. And so it raises the question, or I think thoughtful political analysis will come and look at the situation and say, why with gas prices being so high, why with crime and public safety being such a concern that they are for Minnesotans, is a candidate for governor going out there and talking about retaliating against an oversight board based on investigations that have been looked at upon him? Why is he talking about that? Why is his running mate talking about these phantom properties that may or may not exist in South Dakota where Walz is at? And why is he not talking about bread and butter issues? That fundamentally is why Jensen and Burke are bad candidates.
Well, and Burke particularly, and you bring up Burke, and he's got to stop. If he's going to campaign, he's got to stop following the troll farms, because he got that off of a troll internet troll account, ran with it because it sounded good. Didn't even think for himself, wait a second, I'm Matt Burke. I own property in Wisconsin and in Florida. This is kind of a ludicrous argument, and yet went with it. He, you know, it's just he's not ready to understand. You can't just look at far right wing, you know, internet online memes and think you can run a campaign like that, because right now, yeah, they basically have gone into silent mode because they can't defend his attack on Walz.
And here's the problem: whether you're Tim Walz, whether you're Scott Jensen, whether you're Peggy Flanagan, or whether you're Matt Burke, what all of those candidates want and office holders want is when they stand up in front of a microphone, they want to be able to have credibility. They want the media to respect them. They want there to be credibility in what they're saying. And they want Minnesotans to respect what they're saying. And when and so what Matt Burke has done here is he's made it less likely for the media to believe him the next time he stands up and talks about something, because the prior time he, you know, went out with the microphone, he went out there and regurgitated and passed along information that didn't have much basis in fact, or they haven't been able to produce any evidence. And that makes him a less credible spokesman, advocate, voice for the ticket that he wants to be. Now, if you're a Democrat, you want that to happen.
Yes.
And I get that.
Yes.
For Republicans, you got to be disappointed in that. And I think where something that I've tried to talk about over the years, Matt, is, you know, Minnesota loses on the whole, because I think it's good to have, you know, spirited, substantive debate on the issues. But, you know, chasing down a phantom property in South Dakota is just not a disciplined message.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jensen is COVID is what got Jensen to where he is. And Jensen has a very difficult time letting go from COVID. This is a subject matter that he thinks in his head he was right about. He's selling T-shirts that say Scott Jensen was right. Dr. Scott Jensen was right. They've made a campaign, inside a campaign, about talking about how Dr. Fauci was wrong and Scott Jensen was right. I think that that's yet to be determined on a lot of subjects, how right Jensen was on some things. I would argue he was wrong about a lot of stuff. But the problem here is that Jensen is this campaign, and you're seeing it in other states. This is, by all accounts, a very good political environment for Republicans for a number of issues, fair or unfair, right or wrong. That's the reality of the environment. Everyone sees that. But I think a number of Republicans should be questioning why the race for governor isn't closer.
Yeah.
And they're not doing better. In one area in particular, there's no evidence of it, and that's in fundraising. I mean, Jensen is massively behind Tim Walz in fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, a very interesting data point about where the donor community, where whether it's the donor community or where average donors feel like giving money to. Tim Walz is well stocked. We're talking, I think the tweet I sent out last week showed that Walz had, you know, over $4 million more,
yeah,
plus of Scott Jensen. When Tim, at this point, roughly this point in 2018, when Tim Walz was going against Jeff Johnson, Walz had a lead of around 500,000. I think if my math is correct, I think seven times as much as he had in before. So Walz is doing very well raising. And so it brings the question of, if this is such a bad political environment and Minnesotans think that Tim Walz is such a bad candidate or a bad governor, why are the fundraising numbers so stark? Why are the fundraising numbers so different? And I think it's an indication about where people are in this race.
Well, and I also will come on out here. You're right. There are a lot of things that are working against Walz right now. Walz is nearly freaking. I mean, he is a very good politician. He knows how to campaign. And him coming on out now saying, okay, so the Republicans aren't going to do a special session, fine. I want to give families $2,000 out of that budget surplus, $1,000 if you're single. I want to give that. The Walz bucks, the Walz checks are going to live, and I want to run with it. He basically has a pretty good message there, which, even though, once again, gas prices, economy, stuff like that, he's got something out there which is going to be really hard for the Republicans, especially Jensen, to knock down. He is not going to be a pushover, and he's coming out swinging right now saying, hey, you know, you don't want to use the budget surplus as we agreed. You don't want to have a special session. Fine. I'll give it away how I want to. And that means giving checks to people. And as much as Republicans hate that kind of messaging, it really does work. Those things generally do pretty well.
It does. And one of the issues that will happen, I mean, I think that this is a tough political environment to be running in right now, particularly running for reelection. I think one of the issues that will come out is whether Minnesotans, and this I think is applicable to any incumbent, is whether they think the incumbent is part of the problem or part of the solution. And I think when Walz is out, you know, talking about some of these things, like he is, and offering, you know, offering some of the solutions, offering, you know, rebate checks and stuff, that's going to be a very appealing message, I think, to a lot of Minnesotans, because it's direct, it's understandable, it's not complex, it's money that is taxpayer money going back to the taxpayers, and it gives Walls an opportunity to message. And you got to wonder, in this type of political environment, if we're to believe the race is as close as it is, if we're to believe there's supposed to be this groundswell movement of all of these things, why is the fundraising race not closer? And I would argue that's a good barometer about the closeness of this race. Mm-hmm. I still believe this is going to be a close race on Election Day. I still give the advantage to Governor Walz. But Jensen is going to have to close the gap quickly on fundraising, because not only is it just Walz who's got a massive cash lead, it's the DFL party. And if both sides can agree, if Republicans and Democrats can agree that there's a pool of undecided voters there, whoever has the most money and the best campaign operation to get to those undecided voters, that's how this race is going to be won. And so Scott Jensen can have his Twitter videos and Facebook Live events and do all this type of stuff. But you and I, Matt, you and I both know that this is going to be a campaign that Minnesotans are going to want to see their candidate on TV. As of right now, Jensen does not have any type of resources whatsoever to broadcast a message on statewide TV of any significance. And so what could end up happening here over the next few weeks and few months is that the Democrats can be up with ads defining Jensen before he has an opportunity to define himself. And that's where the race starts to, I think, really start to spread. But it's still a great political environment for Republicans, so we'll see.
We'll have to see. I mean, well, obviously, Roe v. Wade, that ruling will affect things. But the Democrats and Walz will spend that money. Here's the other problem that Jensen has, and it has nothing to do with his campaign. You have been very vocal. Kim Crockett is an atrocious candidate for Secretary of State. We just had, I mean, the anti-Semitic video from the convention aside, which is not a light thing to say, she just was on another interview where she clearly doesn't understand how people vote in Minnesota, yet she wants to run that office. Blue Stem Prairie has the Max Halperin pointing out that she basically doesn't seem to understand what's going on there. You and I have seen this. We have seen on both sides of the aisle good candidates get taken out because one candidate within that group is just atrocious. And right now, Kim Crockett is an atrocious candidate for Secretary of State.
She's terrible. She's an absolutely terrible candidate. Not only are there a number of issues about her personal views that I think would. Racist views that she's apologized for herself. It's very clear that she fundamentally doesn't understand the functions of the office that she's running for. And if there's one thing I think Minnesotans want in the office of the Secretary of State, a race that oversees elections, is someone who understands how elections work and how the functions of the office works. And Crockett, I think, has been very effectively shown to not understand the basic functions of how the Office of Secretary of State works. And she is another candidate who's been in some degree hiding. She's been out there since in the aftermath of the state convention and that anti-Semitic video that was put out. She's been flying under the radar screen in campaigning in somewhat safe areas where she's not going to face scrutiny, but on Twitter and on social media, people have shown, Max has shown very effectively how Crockett just fundamentally doesn't understand the basic functions of her job, mm-hmm. of the job of Secretary of State. And it just shows that she's not ready for prime time. And I think she could cost other candidates opportunities in this race because she has shown herself to be such a caustic candidate, a candidate that is not only incompetent in her knowledge of the race in the office that she's running for, but some of her political views, some of her personal views related to members of the minority community and other stuff her candidacy has just failed to get off the ground.
Well, and you
and
know,
I don't think she's in.
Well, and you and I both know you have to win suburbs. And you're going to have to win some of these. Anti-Semitism and racism doesn't float there. But as well, people don't – you just nailed it perfectly. You're not going to go into Plymouth or Maple Grove or Woodbury or Stillwater and win over those voters by not even knowing how your office works. That is going to be one of those things where, as you said – when you're looking at the Senate being up for grabs, there's a lot of seats the Republicans are hoping they might be able to purge from those tertiary suburbs. Kim Crockett on that ticket's going to do some damage to that idea.
Oh, there's no question about it. There's no question about it. I think that the delegates made a substantive mistake in endorsing Kim Crockett, and the level of scrutiny given to her was questionable at best. It's problematic. And, you know, this is by all accounts, it's a good election cycle. It should be a good environment. And, you know, for all of the talk that Republicans have about election integrity and election issues, you think that they would have been able to endorse a candidate who is at least conversationally knowledgeable in the functions and of her office. It's very clear now why Kim Crockett is, in essence, shying away from the media and doing these softball interviews where she's not getting any type of substantive pushback. It's because she fundamentally doesn't understand how the job works. And that's not going to, she is just simply not a candidate that's ready for prime time. And Republicans who are trying to maximize on the wins that they're facing this election cycle are really going to have a missed opportunity with Crockett as the candidate, because she is going to be a real problem for some of these other candidates.
MichaelBroadcorp.com. And I will make sure you know, when you do go there, get his fine book. That's on the right there. The Girls Are Gone. You can find that book there. That's a great summer read if you have not read that book. If you'd like more there of Michael Broadcorp, you can find it there. And, of course, follow his Twitter feed. He has definitely got a very good view of what's going on within the Republican Party as this election cycle goes through. Michael, your insights are fantastic. I appreciate you talking about Watergate as well, my friend.
Thank you so much. I always appreciate the opportunity to be on, and I look forward if there's an opportunity in the near future, man.
Of course, without a doubt. Michael Broadcorp, kind enough to join us. Let's take a break. Come on back. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Good to have you with us today. I will say, and Broadcorp, and one of the things that he brought up there is the idea of when we're talking about Watergate is what would be the resonating factor. Now, I have talked a few times. One of the things that people don't realize, I think it was 2 days before Nixon resigned, he was at a sold-out crowd in Indiana who they loved him. They were, oh, he's the greatest. We love him. And then 2 days later, he was gone. When Ford pardoned him, one of the things which was interesting was that the Republicans back then were furious with Ford because he handed the Democrats the 76 election. And desperately wanted to replace him on that ticket with Ronald Reagan out of California. And, you know, and Reagan saw an opportunity there. It was, I mean, there were some people who were upset in regards to the feeling that the Republicans didn't stand up for Nixon enough, but it wasn't like it is today with Trump in any way. And that's the difference. Down in Texas this weekend, the people of Texas, and Patrick, you mentioned this, the people of Texas, the Republicans down there, their official platform, they had a few thousand people show up at their convention. Their official platform is that Joe Biden was illegitimately elected president of the United States. He's not the legitimate president of the United States. That is a statewide Republican Party's official stance. That is insanity.
That is. And I don't want to delve too much into the what ifs, but what does that mean? Does that mean they have to recognize Donald Trump as the president? Does that mean they have to actively undermine Joe Biden, or is it just going to be posturing and noise that doesn't really mean anything other than to get attention? That's kind of what concerns me, because if that's your platform, that means they may try to act on it in some way.
Well, and exactly, and that's it's very reckless that if someone all of a sudden, you know, in Texas, you know, tries to take a shot at Joe Biden saying he's illegitimate, I guarantee you the same Texas, well, when we said he was illegitimate, now we didn't mean he wasn't the president. We disagreed with how things happened. But you can't drive that line. And no, you did not have state parties in 76 putting forward platforms which said, you know, Nixon was innocent. Nixon didn't need to resign. That wasn't the Republican parties at that point. So it is a very different world that we are in right now. And, you know, I'll go with what John Oliver said on Last Week Tonight, which is that, you know, this is, it seems like for a lot of Republicans, the mentality is, damn right, we tried to overthrow the country. And if we get it, if you elect us again, we'll do it again. And the Republican supporters are like, yes, I want the end of democracy. I mean, these are literally the stupidest human beings that the planet has ever produced. And, you know, and they're not being led by really smart, intelligent people. And so it's the dumb leading the dumb. And you know, and I feel sorry for Republicans who are intelligent, because there are a lot of intelligent Republicans out there. But, you know, it, at the end of the day, it comes down to you guys saying, no, 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 you're the enablers. The moderate Republicans are the ones who are going into the voting booth and seeing Trump and seeing this slime and seeing all this disgusting nature and saying, well, I don't. And your mentality isn't, I love the Republican, I'm going to vote. It's just, I just don't want to see the Democrats win, which is not the problem. The Democrats aren't the ones trying to actually overthrow the government of the United States. So unless you guys go in, the moderate Republicans go into the voting booth and say, you know what, I'm for lower taxes, I'm for cheaper gas, I'm not for clubbing Capitol police officers and trying to hang the vice president, who, by the way, is a member of the party I supposedly support, I'm not for that. Until you guys walk away, this is going to continue. And I can tell you right now, nothing will clean this country up faster than in what looks like it's supposed to be an easy layup for the Republicans if they get destroyed in this election cycle. Because I guarantee you, then all of a sudden everyone's going to be like, oh, I don't know why everyone got the idea we were so pro-Trump and pro-overthrowing the government. Now, granted, it would take a pretty decent Democratic messaging, and I don't think that's coming. But, It is what it is. That's for sure. Let me go on. I mentioned with Broadcorp about Governor Walz. He's trying to revive the possibility of direct payments to taxpayers in an interview with WCCO Television, saying he wants a 15-minute special session to give individuals about $1,000 and families $2,000 using half the state's budget surplus. It's not a bad plan, man. Walz, who's seeking re-election this fall, sounded like he was reading from the same script as his Republican colleagues talking about tax cuts. The biggest thing we can do is improve the quality of life for Minnesotans right now is to put the money back in their hands. While Republican, but you see, it's what he's doing is brilliant. Republicans don't really want to put the tax dollars back in everyone's hands. They want to put the tax dollars in the wealthy people's hands. They don't want to put it into middle and lower class hands. And that's Governor Walz, and he's taking their campaign point and now using it against them. This is actually really smart. Walz and legislative leaders broke off negotiations for a special session last week, dashing hopes that the two sides would reach an agreement on spending in the state's $9.3 billion projected budget surplus. DFL House Speaker Melissa Hortman said on Monday morning her caucus would go along with a special session on direct payments without more negotiations on DFL spending priorities or for schools or infrastructure. She said she thinks her caucus would approve but hasn't asked them yet. As for doing it in 15 minutes, that would require modifying the rules. Otherwise, the fastest they can get is done in about 3 days. So there is that. So, it's not – I mean, Walz gets it, and this is the problem for Jensen. Is he's out there talking about, I'm going to find every member of that medical review board and I'm going to run them out of town. I mean, that seems to be his main,
I've got my list of people I'm going to get revenge on. Elect me. You know, that's not a winning strategy. And Walls has a lot of money, and we haven't really even gotten to the craziness of, I guarantee you, some of those Jensen rallies that he was appearing out in rural Minnesota back during the height of the pandemic and the stuff he was saying out there, I guarantee you that stuff is going to be coming into to ad campaigns. And right now, his biggest asset seems to be this large pile of flesh behind him in Matt Burke, who doesn't seem to understand what an internet troll is, and says, an internet guy says Gardner Walls bought a piece of property in South Dakota. Ah, gotcha. Well, you know, it's, I love when Broadcorp explained that. I'm not quite sure why that's a problem. Gotcha. Zinger. Og did good. Oh, man. Burke, sit down. Blood's good. You get too much blood rushing from your head, you're going to fall down. So sit down. Relax. Internet troll is not your friend there, Og. You need some help there, okay? So, only Walls can call a special legislative session, and he would be reluctant to do so without an agreement inked beforehand. Less lawmakers in the session in an unpredictable direction. Only the legislator can adjourn himself. So once again, let's step back for a second. What happened here? The Republicans, on certain things, decided it would be more advantageous for them to go into the election cycle without these agreements they made at the end of the session. They would rather run against them not getting passed and hope they can get full control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. What Walls just did is say, okay, fine, if we're going to go with hypotheticals, let's just get rid of what we talked about. I want to go back to what I want to do. Who doesn't want $2,000 per family in this state? I do. It'd be nice. $1,000 per individual? Hey, that cover is going to cost at least 12 or 13 fill-ups of the gas tank. Thank you, Governor Walls. And now the Republicans have to be the ones going, that's reckless and irresponsible. We can't. We have all that money pegged to go to millionaires and billionaires. We can't give it to the blue collar worker. They're just going to waste the money. We need to give it to wealthy people because then they'll basically make sure their great 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 grandkid never works a day in their life. You know, that's real investment right there. Dude, Reginald the 19th should not have to do anything to pay for that Cristal on that resort beach. My God. That's a cause we can all agree on, can't we? Reginald the 19th. Yes. I'll give Walls a lot of credit on that. That's absolutely an outstanding plan. And it is, like I said, it puts the Republicans on the defensive, especially Scott Jensen, because now all he's doing is sitting there going about talking about how he's going to go out there and get revenge. I'm gonna hunt all those medical review board people down. Every one of them. I'm gonna get them. Vote for me. I don't sound deranged at all. What was that voice in my head? Oh, yeah. Or, no, excuse me, Matt Burke. Sorry, my bad. Durr, I found an interesting internet meme. Don't say anything in public again. We don't want to have another nightmare there. Okay, I'll sit back here and look at the wall. Beep-boo-doo, beep-boo, beep-boo. Perfect. Vote Jensen Burke. Revenge will be mine. Paid for by Governor Tim Walz. Oh, you guys got to hire me. You got to hire me, man. It's like Pinky and the Brain come to life, only, not so much the brain. Well, he was pretty vindictive in that show, so I guess maybe there is some relevant contrast there. Ah! I cannot now look at Matt Burke without every time I see him, I think the first sound that's going to come out of that guy's mouth when he starts talking is, ah! Good luck, Republicans. Hell of a ticket you got there.
952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Joe Biden is also going on the offensive here as he's getting looking at the midterm elections. We'll talk about that when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Better when you improvise a story we had. You adore me.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Joe Biden as well is kind of getting in on this. President Biden said on Monday that he'll decide by the end of the week whether to order a holiday on the federal gasoline tax, possibly saving U.S. consumers as much as 18.4 cents a gallon. Yes, I'm considering it, Biden told reporters after taking a walk down the beach near his vacation home in Delaware. I hope to have a decision based on the data. I'm looking forward to the end of the week. The administration is increasingly looking at ways to spare the public from higher prices at the pump, which began to climb last year and surged after Russia invaded Ukraine in February. Gas prices nationwide are averaging just under $5 a gallon. Biden said members of his team were to meet this week with CEOs of the major oil companies to discuss rising prices. Biden lashed out at oil companies saying they're making excessive profits while people in the feeling the current crunch of the skyrocketing costs at the pump and inflation. But Biden said he would not be meeting with oil executives himself. I want an explanation for why they aren't refining more oil, which is, yeah, there. That's everything right there. They've got permits, which they have oil underneath those permits. They know it. They're not using them. They're not refining oil to purposely create a shortage. Here's my big problem with this. If all of a sudden, you know, gas prices, the gas tax is given a holiday and you've got 18 cents a gallon is less, you know, do you have any guarantees that the gas companies won't immediately run up there and add 18 cents to the gallon saying, oh, well, yeah, Joe Biden, what are you going to do? Biden administration already released oil from the U.S. Strategic Reserve and increased ethanol blending for the summer in addition to sending. And by the way, all you farmers who are big ethanol farmers, reminder, Trump threw you guys under the freaking bus. God, I ran into a guy. He does covers ag news out in western Iowa. And he says, he talks to a lot of guys that are really pro ethanol, and you'll in one breath they'll change from, God, I can't believe the Republicans screwed us over and, you know, basically were going against us on ethanol. They really were. I can't believe they did this. And, you know, the next thing is, Joe Biden needs to go. He's horrible. Yeah, I appreciate him trying to help us with ethanol, but he's got to go. And you're like, wow, you guys can't get out of your own damn way at this point. But yeah, Republicans. They could walk into their house, find Trump sleeping with their spouse, and the first words out of their mouth will be, damn Democrats! That's who they are. That is the Republican Party today. Those efforts have yet to reduce gas prices meaningfully because basically the oil and gas companies, who, by the way, funny story, we prop up with massive taxpayer handouts. I know, the biggest welfare queens on the freaking planet. The oil and gas industry gets so much in taxpayer money, and they make massive profits. This isn't capitalism. It's not. And frankly, we have to understand the reason why your gas is so damn expensive is not Joe Biden. It is mostly executives at these corporations who can't jam the money in their pockets fast enough. Oh, gee willikers, golly gosh, Joe Biden's bad. Hey, let me get another $4 billion in profit this quarter. Quarter, not operating expenses. God, how many times do I have to talk to a Republican? It's like, Matt, just because they make all that money doesn't mean that's their money. They got payroll and they got to go spend all that money to keep their businesses. No. Do you understand what the term profit means? No. Profit means that's after all their expenses. I don't care. Okay, let's go, Brandon. I don't care. That's who they are. It's the oil and gas industry. I'm actually of the mindset now. I think it's time for the federal government to take over the oil and gas sector. It is. These guys are not our friends. They're not. And at the very least, they are intentionally playing politics with gas prices to try to get political outcomes that they desire. At worst, they're basically just, you know, trying to they feel as if they have control over this country. And reminder, these same people take these profits and kibosh green technology. They spend millions of dollars trying to stop green electric cars. They want to stop solar panels. They want to stop wind energy. They do everything in their power to basically make it to where they're the only product on the block. And they do that with the obscene profits they make by screwing us all over. Damn right I think it's time for us to take over the oil and gas sector. I absolutely do. And this is the point where Republicans usually come up to me and they say, oh, good, the federal government, whatever happened there? Oh, did you know the Republicans are going to try to take away your Medicaid, Medicare? What? I like that program. That program doesn't need to go away. I like that one. Well, that's the federal government. Well, but I'm okay. They do that okay. Well, they probably could do the oil and gas sector okay. No, that would be profit. That's got to be profit. Ah, I see. Well, then shut up, if I may. Shut your pie hole. Ha, there you go. You want to complain about gas prices, but you don't want to actually say the real culprit behind them, which is the oil and gas executives? Well, shut up. Because you're perfectly fine with the gas prices as long as you can use that price to politically attack someone who has nothing to do with that price. Which makes you a hack. Absolutely. So just shut up. Joe Biden, he's trying to find a solution. You are the problem. 952-946-6205, hour two up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Hour two of the extravaganza on your Monday. Just FYI, by the way, later this week, I'm going to be taking some time off here. Got Pride weekend. I mean, there's so many things to do in this town, and I got a story here that's it's going to be, I'm going to look so forward to sharing this story with you, everyone out there, in just a little bit. But there's too many things to do in town, so I'm going to go around and have a lot of fun and enjoy things as they're going. Still 99 degrees outside. Patrick, how did you weather this weekend of god-awful heat in Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Not very well because the air conditioner decided to give out.
No! Oh, no! Well, is it an outside unit or one of those window models?
It's an outside unit. The earliest they can look at it is Thursday. Fortunately, by then, it should be a little bit of a respite from the heat, but then it should be ready to go for when the heat comes back next week.
So everything else is working, though?
Yes.
So you don't want to... Yeah, at least your fridge is going and stuff like that. It's just, oh, man. It's like a little bit like a kiln at your place?
Pretty much, yeah.
I got out yesterday, Father's Day. I hope you had a nice Father's Day yesterday. At Juneteenth, it is that was yesterday. The celebration of the federal holiday is today, so everyone's off for the day. That's why you got no mail, banks closed, that sort of thing. But I hope you had a wonderful time yesterday. I went out. I was going to have my kids. We were going to go walk Carver Park Preserve, which is out in the west part of the metro, out kind of over by Minnetrista, that area, out way out west, Chaska area, I think. We got outside. We went out for breakfast. I came out and I just said, you know what? I love you. We're not going to go outside in this. I have kids dragging kids home. So we went over to the MIA. Minneapolis Institute of Arts, and of course, you know, they're in between exhibits there, but my God, it's the insane amount of fine art that's in that place. Holy gosh, you can spend weeks in there in air-conditioned comfort, I might add. Patrick, maybe we could get you sleeping in there. Maybe we can find a place, you know, we get one of those old ancient Chinese pillows. We get you, you know, one of those rooms. They got those rooms that are set up. You know, they got the couch in the room that was from Duluth. You know, we'll have you crash there.
I am totally up for that.
Nice air conditioning. Thank you, Minneapolis. No. Okay. Matt's clarification. No, do not try to live at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. Do not try to do that. But no, I stayed inside. And yeah, just it got to a point where it was just, ugh. just, yeah, you can't really do anything out in this stuff. And I see people out working, and God bless you. Hope you're, you know, drinking water. My kid's got a soccer game tonight. They're not canceling it. I'm like, all right. It's, you know, it's, that's how you get sick kids. That's how, you know, I know they're taking water breaks and stuff like that, but my God, it's going to be nasty out there. But Patrick's right there. They're going to have actually a break here in the weather as far as the temperatures go. It is going to cool down. 89 tomorrow, 87 on Wednesday, 94 on Thursday. Ugh. But back in the 70s, high 70s, low 80s by end of this week and next week. So Pride should be fantastic this upcoming weekend. That's the nice thing. That's the nice thing. Still 99 degrees. 99 degrees. The feels like 106. Yeah. Thanks for that. Feels like a plank to your face. How about we say it like that? Of all the activities that you would, there are some things that are just not conducive to massive brawls, okay? That you would not think to yourself, hey, we went out and did this. We went out to the ball pit at the kids at the Adventure Zone, and we ended up getting into a massive brawl. Wedding reception. Generally, kind of a surprise you're getting into a massive brawl. But I got to tell you, of all the activities outside of maybe Kite Festival, if you were to tell me there was going to be a massive brawl at this, I would have been surprised. Apparently, they were tubing down a river.
How do you get after each other, or did this take place on land after they got off the
tubes? Is it a current base fight? I mean, it's just, you're hoping you go a little faster in your tube so your punch can hit? A brawl on the Mississippi River involving two groups of tubers resulted, not potatoes, tubers as in, you know, people in inner tubes, resulted in one person being stabbed on Sunday. Jesus. Wow. And you brought a knife to the inner tube fight. Okay. Have about 6:30 in a shallow area of the river between Power Dram Road Northeast and Roosevelt North Road Southeast, which is about 6 miles east of Bemidji and Frone Township. According to the Beltrami County Sheriff's Office, the groups totaling about 25 people were tubing down the river when they stopped and got into a large fight in the shallow water, with a 20-year-old Deer River woman allegedly stabbing a 21-year-old Bemidji woman in the arm. That's not good. The victim was met by medics at a nearby bridge, was taken to Bemidji emergency room to treat her injury. The suspect was then found and arrested without incident. She was booked into the county jail, now facing second-degree assault and underage drinking charges. Because I can tell you right now, if you're getting to a brawl on an inner tubing down a river, there's got to be a lot of booze involved. Dear Lord. Dear Lord. I don't quite know what to think about this. You know, let's go to grab your inner tubes. We're getting into a gang fight. No, that's just not something you'd expect to hear. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. All my best to the woman. I hope that she's not permanently injured in the arm, but at the same time, I do have to ask the question, who brings a knife to an inner tube fight? Didn't you like having like an inflatable unicorn you could whap them with? I mean, it's a much better visual. Let's just be honest, for the people on the sidelines, on the shore, watching you guys like chuck beach balls at each other, that'd be a lot more fun.
Pool noodle.
pool noodles. Why? Don't tell me you weren't smacking each other with pool noodles. Now that, you get out your frustration with the other drunk group of tubers, and everyone gets a good laugh. That's the way it should go. So I saw this story. This is out of Bloomberg. And I want to talk a little bit about why I love Minneapolis-St. Paul. Is because I think Minneapolis-St. Paul is resilient. It's beautiful. It's brilliant. I love this town. And yeah, we've had some troubles. But we're trying to fix them We're trying to, at least. And you know what? It's not like there's a massive exodus of anything, of people leaving the city. On quite the contrary, people are still coming here. As much as white guy in the third tier suburbs likes to sit there and go, it's a hellscape. The reality is you can stay out there. We don't want you here. We're doing dance parties in the streets. We have good restaurants. We have a lot of people that are coming in here and trying to, you know, buy houses and live and have a great quality of life. So you can go. And the argument that the right comes forward with, they always come forward with the same argument as always. The gun crime. The crime. It's the least safe place in the world. Not quite. No, actually, not quite. Reading the article by Justin Fox, since the summer of 2020, the United States has been experiencing a deadly wave of violence in New York City has not been immune. This is New York they're talking about here. The number of homicides in the city shot up 47% in 2020 and rose another 4% last year. While the tally is down 9% so far this year, there have been some shocking murders, not to mention mass shootings on the subway, and miraculously didn't take any lives. Regular consumers of the news would thus be forgiven for believing that the Big Apple has become a terribly dangerous place. And yes, it is marked some more dangerous than it has been before the pandemic, but I'm not here to dismiss concerns about rising crime in that city. But a little context in his order, and basically you need to look at a lot of charts. In historical context, which is a fair number of people are aware of, that is, New York's pandemic murder wave followed a long decline, with the city's homicide rate in 2021 still less than a fifth of what it was in 1990. The geographical context, which seems to be less widely understood, is that while homicide rates fell sharply all across the U.S. in the 1990s, the decline slowed in the 2000s, reversed starting in 2015. In Philadelphia, the homicide rate is now worse than it was in the early 1990s. Chicago, it's close, which means that there is a growing gap between New York City and most of the rest of urban America. New York, where he happens to live, just isn't just safe relative to other big cities, though. The data from the chart above are from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the local police departments, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also keep track of homicides as reported on death certificates, and one can sort them by, among other things, whether they befell residents of a county that contains all or part of the biggest city in the large, much population of 1 million or more, metropolitan area, a fringe suburban county such as a metropolitan area, or elsewhere. Suburban counties and large metro areas have tended to have the lowest homicide rates, but New York City's was even lower from 2017 to 2019, which was only slightly higher in 2020 and the most recent year for which the CDC has full data. The CDC's wide-ranging online data for epidemiological research, a.k.a. WONDER, databases with which this writer's become familiar with, contains statistics on every other cause of death listed in the ICD-10, the 10th edition of the World Health Organization's International Classification for Diseases. Some causes for death other than homicide seem pretty relevant to assessing safety. Your risk of getting killed on the subway or in a subway station is much higher in New York City than in a place with no subway, for example. But if you add up all the risk related to getting to work or school or wherever else you need to go, it is a very different story. New Yorkers are only about as third as likely to die in transportation accidents of any kind as Americans are overall. Put homicide and transportation risk together, and New York starts looking like a refuge from the American carnage. I've talked about this. How many car accidents have we seen in rural Minnesota? I mean, it's an epidemic out there. It is far more dangerous on the roads in rural Minnesota than it is in the metro area. I guarantee you that, just because of the number of accidents that you're seeing out there. And when you factor in the population county where these accidents are happening versus the population of, say, Hennepin County, it is even more stark. All these accountings leave out the September 2001 terrorist attacks, if included, those would push New York combined homicide and transportation mortality rate from 2001 to 32. Remarkably, though, that's only a slightly higher than the rate for that year for rural and small town America. Counties not part of a metropolitan area, which contains about 86% of the U.S. population in 2021. Rural life, in particular, driving long distances on two-lane roads from emergency services can be a high-risk activity. There are other accidental threats listed in the ICD-10 that seem less salient in the city than in the country, and in some cases the suburbs. To name a few, contact with a power lawnmower, drowning and submersing in a swimming pool, contact with venomous snakes and lizards, victim of a volcanic eruption. I ran the numbers for mortality from all external causes. The mortality rate between New York City and the rest of the country is even bigger in this chart than the last one. And basically what he does is it shows that the when you get out there to the non-metro areas, the external causes for death for 100,000 in the population is 103.7. In this case, New York City is at 51.3. So when you factor all the causes of death in, it is more dangerous in rural America than it is in New York City. But the reason why people like to put this narrative out there is because it's gun crime. It's those gangs and the black people. That's what they like to say. The reality is, factoring all that in, you are far more safer in a metro area than you're out in rural America. I'll tell you what, I'll take a break right now. Come back. More on this story, because it is amazing when you put this all together and you factor in roads, you factor in, you know, all the ways people are dying. And guess what? It is far safer in the cities. And funny story, Minneapolis does show up in these final numbers too, but not in the way the Republicans want you to believe. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, if you factor in all these things, all the causes of death that happen, it's by far less safe in rural America than it is in the metro areas. It is by far. Now, the author of this Bloomberg story does come back and make the argument. He says that there are some things which are a little thing. The explosion of drug that add to the numbers kind of in a bit of a false way. The explosion of drug overdose deaths in the U.S. over the past decade is one of the most depressing trends to encounter in CDC Wonder. But it does take somewhat a field of what people usually have in mind when they consider whether their place is safe or dangerous. Because we don't. We think of a drug overdose as an individual issue, not as a societal issue. And so it's kind of one of those things where they – and I can tell you right now, my God, how many interviews have I done on this show about – you know, the rise of meth and drugs in rural America, my God, the death rates out there of those are just skyrocketing. But once again, we think of that as a individual issue, not a societal issue. Same thing goes for suicides, which have risen but not as sharply. Then there are external causes such as falls and surgical complications that are usually fatal only for the very old. If included in the calculations, they tend to make retirement communities look terribly dangerous, which is not really right. So the author goes through and says, here's what mortality from existing causes looks like if one excludes, one, accidental poisoning, how drug overdoses are classified, so you remove them, intentional self-harm, so suicides, we remove them, falls, you remove them, complications from medical or surgical care, remove them, and external causes of morbidity and mortality after effects that are also fatal for mostly for the elderly. So basically, you know, they have surgery, they survive the surgery, but then they have after effects and they, you know, that's the cause. So when you look at that, and once again, you minus all those, you look at non-metro areas, the average death rate per 100,000 of the population is 43. For New York City, it's 14.3. It's basically almost a third less than it is in rural America. Small metro areas, 33.9. Medium metro areas, I'm going to guess like a Duluth or a Mankato, 31.4. Central counties, large metro, so that's for like a Hennepin County, it would be 28.2. Fringe counties, large metro, which are generally the safest areas in a city, which would be 28.4. So that would be like Carver County or a Wright County in the state of in Minneapolis, St. Paul. They come in 24.8. And then for, in this case, New York City, 14.3. By far the safer place when you factor in all these deaths is the metro areas.
The overall lesson, see, and once again, and that's after you remove drug overdoses, you remove suicides, you remove complications from surgery, falls, and then repercussions of surgery where that might that the recovery from the surgery might not be the problem, but there might be another issue. The overall lesson seems to be the more urban your surroundings, the less danger you face. High homicide rates in some cities mean that the central counties in the large metro areas are on the whole slightly more dangerous than the suburban counties, but that's only the only exception. The risk of death from truly external causes, as defined here, is three times higher in rural and small-town America than in the country's largest city. This is the opposite from conventional wisdom that it's worth teasing out and why. One obvious explanation is that murder scares people a lot more than accidents do, and homicide risk is, in fact, highest in urban counties, not just in New York City. Yet another fact is that a colleague put it to me, you may be less likely to be a victim of a crime in New York City, but you're more likely to witness one. In dense urban environments, you simply see more of what's going on for good and ill. It's also possible that the issue is not much urban versus rural as it who lives there. An affluent rural or exurban county where lots of people can work from home might be a lower risk than a poor urban one where most can't. Rural counties in Appalachia or the Deep South might be very different profiles from those in the New England and the Plain States. A look at the 2020 selected external causes of the mortality of the state offers some support of the latter interpretation. And it basically said it shows that the safe states versus dangerous ones. Well, Minnesota is their death from selected external causes per 100,000 population is 30.6. 30.6 is the national rate. In Minnesota, it's 22.1. You go down to Mississippi, holy God, it's 63.7. It's three times higher in Mississippi. Louisiana is 54.7. You kind of get the idea. South Carolina, 46.7. Arkansas, 50.1. Alabama, 48.2. Kentucky, 44.2. The only exception really of that of the non-traditional Republican voting states would be Maryland, which is at 56.7, still well below Mississippi. Even places like Montana are near twice as bad as Minnesota with 41.8. And so once again, that's just the average. So it is far more dangerous in Montana than it is in Minnesota. It's far more Wisconsin at 27.9. It's 22.1 in Minnesota. Minnesota is safer than Wisconsin. And Iowa, 24.5. Minnesota, 22.1. Minnesota is safer than Iowa. South Dakota, sweet Lord, 34.8 is your death from external causes per 100,000 of the population. They're above the national average. 30.8, Minnesota, 22.1. North Dakota, 31.5. Minnesota, 22.1. Minnesota is by far the safest state in this region. By far. As a matter of fact, 22.1 is, I'm just going to look, okay, Utah is a little less than us. There it is, a little safer. It's Utah. California is only 23. New York is 18.2. And it's because, and this is, and I know you're saying, it's like, well, you fix the numbers, you make it look. No, what they did is they basically said all causes of death, like road accidents and stuff like that. It's far more dangerous in rural America than it is if you're all you're considering are gang related deaths with guns that involve black people. Probably you're going to find more crime in Minneapolis. But when you factor in causes of death that are not just crime, not just geared toward gangs, not just geared towards minority communities, but you look at the overall cause of crime and you factor in other things such as, you know, gas explosions in houses and cars that are getting cars that are driving 150 miles an hour and rolling and killing everyone, then my God, it's by far more dangerous in rural America than it is in the metro areas. The safest counties in America. So this is where he starts running down the counties. The Loudoun County, Virginia, is a D.C. suburb. That's only 6.4. Douglas County, Colorado, a Denver suburb, is 7.5. Delaware County, Ohio, a Columbus suburb, is 9.4. Somerset County, New Jersey, a New York City suburb, is 10.9. Now, no Minnesota counties, I don't believe, show up in that. But Queens County in New York does. 11.5, and New York County in New York, in Manhattan itself, it's 12.0, way below the national average.
The safest places in America on the reckoning are very affluent suburbs. And I don't think that that's too much of a surprise per se. But once again, it's all these suburbs that are located around metro areas. The CDC knows everything about mortality in the U.S. For privacy reasons, it only shares what it knows if there are 10 or more deaths to report. And because of reliability concerns, it only calculates mortality rates if there are 20 or more deaths. For the collection of external causes, I selected Wonder, the computer program the CDC uses, churned out 2020 deaths totals for 1,711 of the nation's 3,143 counties and county equivalents, parishes in Louisiana, census areas in Alaska, independent cities in Virginia, and some other places. The mortality rates for 997, it provided enough data to calculate the mortality rates for all the counties, but I chose not to use the charts here because he didn't want to skew them. So that's, I mean, he's going out of his way to do his numerical due diligence to not skew these numbers. Here we go. Most dangerous counties in America. Bighorn County, Montana. Now, I want to remind you, Minnesota's death rate of all causes that excluded suicides, drug overdoses, complications from surgery, falls, and ripple effects from surgery. That is 22.1. 22.1 for Minnesota as a whole. Bighorn County, Montana, 168.4. Calhoun County in Mississippi, 161.5. Baltimore County in Maryland, up there, 160. Phillips County in Arkansas, 138. Holmes County, which is a Jackson suburb in Mississippi, 137. Dillon County in South Carolina, 135. Colton County in South Carolina, 133. Hampton County in South Carolina, 132. LaFour County in Mississippi, 129. By far, most of these counties are very rural counties, and it's far more dangerous when you look at the death rate per 100,000 of the population in those counties than it is in other places. Here's where it gets delicious. Here you go. You've stayed with me here. You've stayed with me. So we know that when you look at metro areas, and we're talking metro areas, they're factoring in smaller towns. Ames, Iowa shows up on this list. I mean, that's only like 85,000. So that's a lot of cities that are qualified in what they call metro areas, small metro, medium metro, large metro. When you factor them all in together and you look at the deaths from external causes per 100,000, Bighorn County, by the way, I just want to make sure I go back to this. Bighorn County in Montana, their number was 168.4. For Minneapolis-St. Paul, the number is 16.5. It's 10 times less. 10 times less likely to die in Minneapolis-St. Paul. 10 times less than Bighorn County in Montana. Sweet Jesus, I'm never going to Bighorn County in Montana. Minneapolis falls in, let's see what number it is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. We are the 14th safest metro area in the entire freaking country. Boston, 13.6. New York, 13.9. Provo, Utah, 14.3. Corvallis, Oregon, 14.6. San Jose, California, 15.3. Ames, Iowa, 15.5. So we're talking small towns around this list, and we're still number 14. Wilchester, Mass., that's at 15.6. San Diego, 15.7. Mankato, Minnesota, comes in at 15.8. Manchester, Nashua, New Hampshire, 15.9. State College, Pennsylvania, 15.9. Ann Arbor, Michigan, 16.1. Sheboygan, Wisconsin, 16.5. Tied with Minneapolis, St. Paul, 16.5. San Francisco, 16.9. Which, if I can now point out the real scary part, the metro area's cause of death per 100,000 is only 16.5. In the state of 5,700,000 people. The metro area, I believe, is 3.6 million, which means the rest of the state is so much higher than Minneapolis-St. Paul, it raises Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is the majority of the population in the state, from 16.5 to 22.1 for the entire state of Minnesota. Sweet Lord. It is far less safe in rural Minnesota than it is in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And that's not just me saying it. That's the numbers. And I'm going to make an argument that by far, if you look at car accidents, which are included in on this, you look at drownings, and you look at ATV accidents, is anyone really surprised? But the real crime, if I can call you all you guys out, is all you do is want to label Minneapolis-St. Paul as bad because you see black eye gun, black eye. Thank God I'm in Minneapolis-St. Paul, because as much as you like to try to racially profile the crime here and turn it into something grander, the reality is Minneapolis-St. Paul is by far a safer place to be in the state of Minnesota than pretty much anywhere outside of Mankato. Word. That's called facts. So, Republicans in rural America, clean up your own towns. Now. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. This just makes me smile. Clean up. What the heck are you guys, Republicans? Do you need us in the metro area to stick our nose in your business? Because you got to clean up your messes over there. You guys can't. What is going on? You need to. If you do need a safe respite, come to Minneapolis-St. Paul. We'll take care of you. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Oh, and I can hardly hear. Oh, Matt, how can you disparage rural America like that? Well, first of all, you guys have no freaking problem disparaging metro area life at all, so shut up. Second of all, you need to clean up your own damn towns. You need to start slowing down. You need to stop rolling your freaking ATVs. You need to, you know, try to have maybe more water safety. I'm going to guess a large portion of the problem out there probably involves alcohol. I'm going to go out on a freaking limb here. But when you're the ones that basically want to say it's far less safe in a metro area than it is in rural America. Oh, but you can't count car crashes. You can't count, you know, drug overdoses from the meth epidemic that's spiraled out of control in rural America. You can't count other ways people die. You can only factor in when it's black people and guns and see Minneapolis so much worse. That's your narrative. The reality is Minneapolis-St. Paul, it's by far safer than the rest of rural Minnesota. So, and you can say, and maybe you might have a legitimate argument that the tertiary suburbs, the outlying counties bring down Minneapolis's numbers. Yeah, but they still bring them down. So the average for the metro area itself is 16.5. The statewide average is 22.1, which means you guys need to clean up your own house, because that's not even half the population that's raising it up by 6 points. That's 2/5 of the population that's raising it up by 2 points. That's on you guys. That's on you guys. How about this one? Don't get drunk when you go hunting and think you're shooting at a deer wearing blaze orange. How about that one? Dear Lord. Yeah, you do. You guys got to clean that up. Oh, unless the entire point of what you're doing is racist based. I mean, I guess there's that option. I mean, the entire point of why the Republicans bring up crime is just because they want to say, look over there, black people. I mean, it could be that. I don't know. It would seem that if you're actually trying to make people safer, you'd probably try to clean up your own act. And just saying. I'll post that story a little bit later on. Speaking of Republican hypocrisy, Brooke Alexander turned off her breast pump at 6:04 p.m., brought two fresh bottles of milk over to the bed where her three-year-old twins lay flat on their backs, red-faced and crying. Running on 4 hours of sleep, the 18-year-old tried to feed both babies at once, holding Kendall in her arms while she tried to get Olivia to feed herself while a bottle propped up by a pillow. But the bottle kept slipping and the baby kept wailing, and Brooke's boyfriend, Billy High, would not be home for another 5 hours. "Please, fussy girl," Brooke whispered. She peeked outside the room just big enough for the full-size mattress and realized she had barely seen the sun all day. The windows were covered by blankets pinned up with thumbtacks to keep the room cool. Brooke rarely ventured out into the rest of the house. Billy's dad had taken them in when her mom kicked them out, but she didn't want to get in his way. The hours where Billy were always the hardest, without Billy were the hardest, she knew she had to go. They relied entirely on the $9.75 an hour he made working in line at a Freebirds World Burrito. But she tortured herself, imagining all the girls he might be meeting, and she wished she had somewhere to go to. Brooke found out she was pregnant late in the night of August 29th, 2 days before the Texas Heartbeat Act banned abortions once an ultrasound could detect cardiac activity around 6 weeks of pregnancy. It was the most restrictive abortion law to take effect in the United States in 50 years. For many Texans who needed abortions since September, the law has been a major inconvenience, forcing them to drive hundreds of miles and pay hundreds of dollars for a legal procedure they once could have had at home, but not everyone's been able to leave the state. By the way, I want to remind you, wealthy white Texans, I guarantee you they're not driving anywhere. They're going on down to a local clinic and getting it done there. Wealthy white Republicans, women, they're able, and their kids, they're able to get abortions on demand in their community. This is about the poor people. This is about the minority people. Some people couldn't take a time away from work or afford gas, while others faced a long journey, decided to stay pregnant. Nearly 10 months into the state law, they have started having the babies they never planned to carry to term. Texas offers a glimpse of what the rest of the country could face when the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade this summer. It's been widely expected that since the leaked draft opinion circulated last month, the landmark precedent falls. Roughly half the states in the country are expected to dramatically restrict abortion and ban it altogether, creating vast abortion deserts that will push many into parenthood. Sometimes Brooke imagined her life if she hadn't gotten pregnant, if Texas hadn't banned abortion just days after she decided she wanted one. She would have been in school, rushing from classes to her shift at a Texas roadhouse, eyes on a real estate license that would finally get her out of Corpus Christi. She pictured an apartment in Austin and enough money for a trip to Hawaii where she'd swim with dolphins. When both babies finally started eating, Brooke took out of her phone and restarted the timer that had been running almost continuously since the day they were born. She had 2.5 hours till they needed to eat again. All right, Republicans, why aren't you helping her?
Well, that was an individual.
She wanted to have a choice to get an abortion. You were the people that said she can't have that choice. So you don't want to have any of the consequences from your decision. You want to now all of a sudden act like, well, that was their end of, they had no, that was their call. No. You so-called Christians could be there helping her with, you know, money to help her with her bills, with assistance with daycare, medical expenses, job training. Where are you? Oh, that's right. It's not our problem now. We just hooked you to the boat. Now you're getting dragged out to sea. That's on you. That is what awaits most of America. That, as people who will never give those in need real help, sit and applaud and pat themselves on the back for a job well done. They haven't done anything. They created this mess, and they refuse to do anything to fix it because they don't want to follow the actual obvious trend, which is, you know what? If we're going to demand people have babies, well, then we need to have the social safety net programs in place to make sure that they are covered and, well, I don't know, swaddled like a little baby. Instead, they basically force people to have the kids and then offer no support or assistance whatsoever. Because that's what Republicans consider Christian. And it's not. They're just horrible people. To the Minnesota Reformer, a leaked draft of the U.S. Supreme Court's upcoming decision on undo Roe v. Wade brought a hot flash of relevancy to a billboard-based work of Kelly Cyril and Kristen Britsky. In 2019, the St. Paul couple founded the Minneapolis Billboard Project, a grassroots effort to combat anti-abortion billboards across the metro area with reproductive rights focused billboards created by Minnesota artists. After a voting and census theme collaboration with Ramsey County to reach youth and LGBTQIA plus audiences in 2020 and a smaller effort focused on racial justice in 2021, the Abortion Rights Project is back this year. Fresh off the Supreme Court leak, they introduced the Texas-style bill that would ban and criminalize abortions in Minnesota. Cyril and Britsky say combating the prolific stream of anti-abortion billboards that blanket the state's highways feel more important than ever. If Roe v. Wade gets overturned, Minnesota is going to be one of the only states in the surrounding states that's going to continue to offer abortion services. It's incredibly important to make sure that we're supporting abortion providers. By day, Previous year's efforts placed billboards in St. Paul, Duluth, and Mankato. They chose five of the artists they'd worked with before to create designs for this year's theme. The designs were posted on the project's Facebook and Instagram pages, where the public voted on their favorites and liking the reaction. They picked the ones that they did like. After tallying up the reacted counts, getting input from the diverse executive panel, two winners were announced: KT Linderman's "Everyone Deserves the Right Care" and Destiny Davidson's "Choice is Precious." The billboards will be up near the State Fair and also on Maryland Avenue and Dale Street in St. Paul, and will be up from August through Labor Day. All the donations made to the Minnesota Billboard Project, whether direct or through their newly launched store, will go to paying for the artist $350 in the submissions and covering the cost of the billboards go up. Anything left will be donated to reproductive health care providers across the state. I want to remind everyone that Republicans, if they get in charge, will turn us into Texas, will say you can't have the choice. But then when you say, well, I'm not prepared, I need help to raise this kid, they'll say, well, that was your call. We had nothing to do with it. That was all on you. That's what the Republicans are going to do. We need to make sure. I love the Billboard Project. I love all this stuff. But we need people to get to the polls and vote. That is the most important thing. Vote DFL, because you don't want to be like Texas. And right now, if you look at the surrounding states, I guarantee you, Minnesota is there are a lot of people in Wisconsin and Iowa and the Dakotas who are praying abortion stays legal in Minnesota, so that at least they have that option. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make a gut call here. I honestly think if Roe v. Wade gets thrown out, you're going to see a massive exodus from some of these anti-choice states to states like Minnesota. People are 18-year-olds, even. And matter of fact, if I may be bold, I think Minnesota should actually get an ad campaign saying, hey, come to Minnesota. We'll never basically try to legislate your reproductive rights. If you're 18 years old, do you want to basically have some wealthy white, right, Republican, Christian, conservative basically telling you how your body operates, or do you want to make those calls on your own? And I think you're going to see from 18 years old, and I think this is going to be a nightmare for colleges in some of these states. You're going to see people leave in droves that don't want to. I'm not going to be down there. I'm not going to, you know, have these people legislate my ovaries. No. They're going to run in mass out of these states. And as a matter of fact, someone made the suggestion, in Minnesota, maybe what we should do is offer them in-state tuition if you have left a state due to its restrictive reproduction rights, that you can get in-state tuition. Guarantee you, University of Minnesota will become one of the biggest freaking colleges on the freaking planet. Oh, that would be huge. I think there's going to be a massive exodus. The key here is this. Minnesota, we can't screw this up. We already know what they're going to do. They want to jail women who get an abortion. They want to jail you. They want to, in some places, they've suggested laws where women are strapped down to beds or restricted from leaving the state to prevent them from having the choice over their own bodies. Now, I'm going to make sure I remind everyone, I personally am against abortion. But that ends with me and my wife, and really ends with her. It's, you know, her body. I'm not going to – I can let my opinion be known, but that's the end of that. The reality is this, because of what you see in Texas, the fact that wealthy white Republican women are still able to go to their strip malls and get their abortions on demand while the rest of the people of Texas have to basically be told there's no option for you. And because the state of Texas goes down there and doesn't even offer assistance or help to these people who they have now demanded carry these babies to term, forgive me if I say that is not Christian. That is not Christian in any capacity. That's just basically fake piety. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Native Roots Radio coming up here at 6. We'll wrap up the show when I do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I do think that that's going to be the case. I think there's going to be a massive exodus by people 18 and older, and especially initially. It's going to look like a lot like rural America, where you go out to rural America, and one of the things you see is that the people there are 55 and older or 18 and younger because they left years ago and they haven't come back. And I think that that's what's going to happen. Initially, you're going to have a massive flux of people leaving states where there are no, you know, reproductive rights. And I think what you're going to start seeing is 18 years old. Well, I'm not going to stay in Texas. I'm going to Minnesota. And it is going to be very interesting when you look at a lot of these schools. I mean, we've just had the NCAA softball tournament, the NCAA baseball tournament. You know, it's going to be very interesting for these colleges to look at these women and say, you know, I'm coming here to play. What are they going to do? Impose no sex standards for athletes because you're not going to be able to get an abortion in that state, and the state's not going to let you go get one? Well, then I'm just not going to play for you. I'm not going to have my college dictate my health care choices. I'll go play for a college that will allow me to make my own choices for themselves. 952-946-6205. I think that's going to be very interesting how that develops. Last thing here, no Minnesota coronavirus update. The numbers, I don't think that maybe with the Juneteenth holiday, they didn't post anything today. Minnesota children ages 6 months to 5 years will be able to receive a Pfizer COVID vaccine, the Mall America vaccination site, and clinics and pharmacies across the state in the near future. The first doses are expected to be injected in the arms of young children who are just last week authorized to receive the vaccine by the Food and Drug Administration beginning as soon as Wednesday. That's when the Mall of America site reopens. The MOA vaccination site is open Wednesday through Friday from 1 till 8 p.m. Saturdays from 9 until 4 p.m. Appointments are required. Okay, you have to have an appointment for the Mall of America site. The state will also soon ship the child-sized doses to health providers and pharmacies around the state. Once the doses are in stock, the state expects the majority of sites offering the vaccine to begin distributing them within a week. My guess is going to be hospitals and some of the larger pharmacies. That's going to be my guess out there. Reminder, it will be interesting what Scott Jensen has to say on this. Is he going to never let them do it? Just stop them! Stop them! It's not safe! Dr. Jensen, where is Dr. Jensen? This was a major talking point. Wasn't kids and vaccines a major talking point for Jensen? Oh, I'm sure he's got a lot to say. Oh, zipping the lip, I see. Have a good one. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.